So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, will a cash injection bring children back to TV? We discuss which face of 80s pop culture is getting a lift, the second ever gender pay gap survey that makes for uncomfortable reading, and Global's Billboard takeover. Plus, we'll play their word against ours in the media quiz. It's all to come, today's Media Podcast. And joining us today in Veteran Contributor Corner is the Managing Director of Indie Goldwalla. It's Faraz Osman. Hello, Faraz.
Hey, Ollie. How you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. What's exciting you? What's floating your boat at the moment?
Beyonce's on Netflix. The sun's shining. I've had some ice cream. Sorry, I like your shirt.
You've got Easter all set up. Okay. And making her media podcast debut, it's broadcaster Jane Garvey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ollie.
You were one of the first voices, in fact, the first voice on Five Live, I believe.
I was the first voice.
How did you feel come this 25th anniversary?
Bloody old, depressed. I think actually they didn't involve me in the celebrations this year. I think it's like they want to pretend I never existed because I'm a bit old, bit Radio 4 and a bit tragic. So I noticed I was kept out of any. I didn't get any cake.
Maybe they just couldn't afford you, Jane.
Well, as we know, everyone can afford me. didn't even get an invite to Salford. So yeah, it was all a bit miserable. But anyway, there you go. I did tweet about how delighted I was to be around for Five Live's 25th birthday.
I mean, it's changed quite a lot since you. I mean, not just in the sense that
Daniel, mate, hasn't it?
Well, this news and sport idea, that feels like something from 25 years ago. If you were launching a news network now, would you have Let's Break for the Live Football?
You see, Five Live continues to be my favourite radio station. It is the station I listen to more than any other. And I'm sure I'm not in a minority. I am interested in live football commentary and Brexit and everything else going on in the world. And I'm afraid, one of the things that they did do on the day of the birthday was, I think it might have been on the Radio Today podcast, they played a bit of audio from the drinks party that was held at Broadcasting House on the morning that Five Live started. And an impossibly stuffy woman from one of the broadsheet newspapers was asked what she thought. And she said something like, this is after hearing the launch breakfast show, which I did with Peter Allen. She said, it was something about football, and I don't know who's going to listen. And I just thought, ooh, love, you sound, in 25 years
history
on,
has not been kind.
She didn't sound any better. And I am absolutely convinced there are millions of people like me with a broad range of interests that includes sport, live sport, politics, international news. I want it all. And to be fair, I get it all on Five Live.
Is she wrong, Faraz? Shouldn't they just put the football on Sport Extra?
I absolutely agree. I think the thing about Five Live is it feels like a proper, without kind of sounding really sycophantic, but it feels like a proper public service. And in an era where, you know, news is breaking all the time and things are happening all the time, it's actually quite comforting to be able to know that there's a place that's not shouty 24-hour news on the TV that you can flick on, and you know that you'll be getting the story that's breaking right now. What is interesting is that sometimes I find that you turn on Radio 5 Live, you're not sure if you're going to get the football or if you're going to get what's going on in the Houses of Parliament right now. And that kind of whole understanding about, and it's interesting what Talk is doing with Talk Sport and Talk Radio, is that right? You know, kind of almost spitting it out. And so those two things kind of bouncing against each other is kind of part of the charm of it. But I do think it's interesting about how it is a real useful, wherever you are, doesn't matter if you're in front of a TV or not in front of a TV, you're closer to live news that can be authored and properly edited in a way that Twitter or, you know, all of those things that we have been jumping to in the last few decades. Actually, 5 Live provides something that you can cut through all of that noise and get what's going on live and in the moment, which I think is a great thing.
And I think, Jane, you were kind of plucked from local radio, weren't you, for 5 Live?
Yeah, well, this is before. You couldn't hear me anywhere other than by coming to Worcester, where in fact I was broadcasting at the time. So, although I suppose they must have been able to get hold of cassettes of my seminal work.
I'm sure there was a black market.
Yeah, I bet there was. BBC Hereford and Worcester. But I wasn't plucked, I applied.
Okay.
I think the BBC gets away with this all the time.
To be fair, it was Rod Sharp's version of it, was that you
okay,
were plucked. That's what I heard.
Yeah, but
it wasn't
the BBC
an official...
says this. And people at, and not just about, obviously not about me, because who gives a toss about me, but plenty of other people, they sort of like to take credit for plucking them. You hear that a lot. Rubbish. I applied and got through and was selected. And then they also spin this idea that Peter Allen and I were some kind of dream team that were put together. They just couldn't find anybody else in the end. And Peter was, I don't think, but he knows this, he wasn't the first choice to do the breakfast show. I certainly wasn't. And they were just kind of, I thought, oh God, well, I think honestly, a lot of people thought, stick him on at the beginning, it'll be a terrible failure. And then we can get some good people in once we've established the network in a couple of months' time.
But that career progression is kind of unprecedented now, isn't it? If you're listening to this and you work in BBC local radio and you'd like to think one day I could be on air for a national. Won't happen.
I do think you're right there, and I think that's a real shame. And I think Radio 4 also has to look at itself a bit here. I did some programmes with BBC Radio Sheffield and Woman's Hour, some sort of simulcasts and working together. And the brilliant mid-morning presenter they've got there is called Paulette Edwards. I'm sorry, she is at least as good as almost any other presenter on Radio 4 and 5 Live. And I think you're right. I'm not sure how the Paulettes of this world are going to get onto national radio, because once you're on national radio, people don't move, and there's it's wrong. And I think at Radio 4 we are at the moment trembling in anticipation of the announcement of our new controller. And I think the new controller of Radio 4, they've whittled it down to four people. I think they are going to have to make some big, bold, and some might say difficult decisions about the network.
With whatever money they have left after it's gone to BBC Sounds.
With the £7.50 that's knocking about in the coffers.
I have to say that the thing is, though, is that two things. I think local radio does need more love, and if it's being used as a career path, that's not necessarily a good thing. I think having local voices that become really familiar in those places and it's not always seen as a job application for a national radio show is, you know, I would argue that there's a lot of credit to that. And there is some really interesting things happening in radio with, you know, Tiffany, who's now doing the Radio 1 rap show, and I think it's Daisy who's doing the Kiss breakfast show now, after there's been like a bit of a round robin going on with lots of people moving to Radio 1 and moving to Beats 1 Radio, and that's kind of allowed an opportunity for new talent to come through. And those guys have been doing stuff online. A lot of them have been doing their own radio stations in their own bedrooms and then being heard via podcasting apps and via social. And that's really kind of led them to jump onto the national stage, which I think is a different path through. And I think it's quite exciting. But I don't think we should, I really don't think we should dismiss local radio as being an opportunity to just kind of promote yourself to national.
What I would say about local radios is it's the place I've worked the hardest at, because local radio presenters work hard and they don't earn a lot of money. I mean, we're talking about people who might well do a 3-hour breakfast show in the morning, possibly now double-headed. They will be driving the desk. I remember I used to work 16-hour days. I'd be out in Herefordshire chatting to a WI in the middle of nowhere.
Did you ever open a supermarket?
I have never opened a supermarket, but I have turned on the Christmas lights in Hereford.
Yes.
Yeah.
Were you a consumer champion?
Consumer champion.
Yeah, I'd like you on my side if someone had installed the wrong kitchen, wouldn't you?
I once managed to get Hereford and Worcester County Council to reinstate the village of Hollybushes Hollybush sign, which had been stolen.
There you are. We're all about the exclusives.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought Farias might be having a go at me there. Was he?
No.
I don't know well enough.
Not at all.
Because he was belittling local radio.
Well, I felt he might be slightly.
Yeah.
I think local radio, long live local radio is what I say.
It's just hard work.
It is hard work. Let's move to the world of kids TV, where the British Film Institute hopes to bring back homegrown children's television to the main channels, as they're still calling them, with an injection of cash. Farias, what's the deal?
Oh, this is nothing but good news. I think that what's happened in kids' TV for a long time is, more recently what's happened is the junk food advertising has, that law has meant that there's been a retraction of kids' content on the commercial channels because they can't find advertisers to effectively fund it. So the government, I think, which is probably the right word, or the state have stepped in and said, right, we need to do more beyond just a licence fee to help British kids' content cut through, which is a very good thing in principle, and hopefully it will allow particularly the non-public service broadcasters to be more tempted into putting kids' content back onto the main channels and allow a bit more particularly of a British tone of voice rather than just doing American imports, which is all a good thing. However, I would say that there is a bit of a concern that this puts in another layer of bureaucracy, and I've got a little bit of a concern about ideas are no longer commissioned just on the basis of how good those ideas are. They're also being commissioned on how many hurdles and hoops you have to jump through to get funding from lots of different places. And it's kind of almost aping that indie film producer arm where you're always kind of trying to find money here and everywhere to get something made rather than the idea itself cutting through.
So this is the BFI launching the Young Audiences Content Fund. It's worth £57 million. It's coming from the UK government's contestable fund. There's a bit of space for public service audio for children as well of £3
million. Which Sam Bailey, I think, is looking after from Radio 1.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean?
Well, it effectively means the same. It's not just the BBC that are having that hold the public service fund, as it were, and you can go and apply for money, or is that the word? Or get grants for money? I'm not sure exactly the right terminology about how it fits in. But
well, you need to demonstrate, don't you? I think that it's 50% funded by a channel.
Yes.
And then you apply for the other 50%.
But not the BBC.
Well, I think it could include the BBC.
It could end up going on the BBC, but the idea is that there's another route to production, as it were.
I mean, the obvious question, Jane, is isn't this what the BBC's for?
Well, I thought it was. And I thought as well that the BBC, CBBC and CBBC
do
a good job and do well. I remember, I've got lots of media memories, and I'll never forget the morning that CBBC started, because my kids are so old that the older one was born before CBBC's. But we were there on the morning it launched at 6 a.m. And I just remember thinking, my life has just got easier. It was bliss. Mm. It wasn't actually bliss from then on, but it was substantially easier.
How many hours a day of childcare did you delegate to Auntie?
The nation's favourite babysitter.
I suspect like many others, I would.
You're looking for a figure here.
It was a sanity saver. It really was, and there was one particular program which I remember talking to the. Do you remember Come Outside? Have you ever seen that program?
No, I haven't.
Okay, Linda Barron, the actress who was in Open All Hours, original version with Ronnie Barker. Mm-hmm. Everybody's looking blank. Okay, Linda.
No,
Barron.
No, I remember Open All
Hours.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. Linda Barron was a sort of sex pot that was that he was in love with, and anyway, whatever. She played a sort of figure. She was a dog owner's. Mom? No, she was a dog owner. The dog was called Pippin, and they used to fly around in a plane exploring things. It was called Come Outside, and the BBC only made 12 editions of it, but they did some fabulous things together, including one of the best programmes I've ever seen about Britain's sewage system.
I wasn't expecting to say that.
No, which my youngest daughter liked to watch on a loop.
Not on a U-bend.
I left that one open for you. So that's just my memory of Come Outside, Bring It Back.
But actually, you made a good point. 12 episodes, you still remember it. That's the thing with kids' telly, isn't it?
I mean, absolutely.
You can repeat this. I mean, Teletubbies, there's only 50 of them or whatever, but that's kind of fine because the kids only watch it for 6 months.
Yeah, and I think it's incredibly valuable as well because the nostalgia it brings, and I really think the inherent value, you know, I'm a new dad, you're a new dad. It's like, you know, the value of CBeebies and CBBC is
but
massive.
What's wrong with repeats is my point.
There's nothing wrong with repeats. I have no issue with that. There are a few things about only having the BBC and CBeebies being the only place for kids' content, we need to make sure that there's a more of a diversity. And what we're seeing is a lot of kids are going towards YouTube and Netflix and Amazon, which is a very Americanized content in the main, or certainly not as British as some of the things that we hold very beloved. And the second thing, and what I would argue is the most important thing, and I'm on the BAFTA Kids Committee, and we, you know, this is the kind of stool that I sit on, and I'm very passionate about this, is content for teenagers. And so this contestable fund goes up to 18-year-olds. And I've been saying for quite a while that audiences that are 15, 16, 17, 18, that are older than the CBBC audience, are widely ignored by most broadcasters. You don't have any content for those guys.
You get the impression they just give up, don't they? But isn't that because my kids are now teenagers? They find their own content. So the only time you've got to influence them is before they are able to seek out their own content. And that's why it really does matter that I think in particular the BBC does continue to produce high quality and British, you're really right to emphasise that, British shows with British values that we all agree with and we can celebrate.
But I would like to see that across all of the broadcasters, which includes Channel 5 and Channel 4. And this is commercially...
Well, Channel 5 shows this isn't for teenagers.
Milkshake and stuff
like that. No, but it's not because it's not commercial, because it's not commercially viable. And that's why this...
But what I was going to say is Channel 5 shows Thomas. I mean, that is basically British values on an international stage, isn't it? I mean, that's clearly set in England, isn't it?
Yes, but there are clearly gaps. You know, there are issues around kids television in the UK. It's shrunk and shrunk significantly. There is a repeats argument, which is a valid argument. You can repeat a lot of stuff for kids, but there is a time when it becomes tired and old, and you need to make sure you continually refresh it. There are a lot of challenges around kids' TV and around the commercial viability of it, particularly when there has been laws that have come through around junk food advertising, which is, on the whole, a good thing. We need to do what we can to look at childhood obesity, which is a massive issue, but we need to find ways of balancing that. And I think that that's what this fund is going to do. The trick is how are you going to navigate it all in a world where usually you could just go up to commissioner, get an idea commissioned, and not have to worry about speaking to 15 different commissioners, which this could end up creating.
But wasn't kids' TV always a really complex thing to commission? Because I'm talking here not at the teenage end of things, but at the school end of things. Actually, you always needed in place a kind of merchandise deal. You needed to know that there was international distribution.
No, I don't know if I agree with that. Not in the UK. When we were growing up, you know, Channel 4 were doing stuff around education, which was a block in the afternoon, which was remitted by Ofcom, and so there was programming that was made at that time. CBBC was on BBC Two and had lots of attention, which is why you had the whole playground gathering around to watch one particular program, which is why that nostalgia exists, which is now gone. CBBC is now a digital channel, which again is probably a good thing, but it's created differences within the market. And you know, we've now, and ITV used to have CITV again as a block on the main channel, which now doesn't exist. You know, the landscape has changed significantly from when we were growing up, and I think that we are always nostalgic about kids TV, but if you went back and looked at it now, it is very different to what we had when we were growing up, and it's important to reflect that.
I'm actually watching on Amazon Prime at the moment with my 3-year-old reruns of Fireman Sam, which actually came on air just a few years after I was of the right age.
Yeah, I think you'll find there's some controversy over that.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Just say that so it doesn't matter.
But the charm of it, the slow pace of it, is what's amazing watching it now. I mean, you compare it to something...
There was a lot of trouble in Tony Pandy, wasn't there, from my memory?
Yeah. I mean, they needed a bigger department, that's for sure.
Yeah.
and Sam...
Never find that arsonist.
I think it was probably Sam. I think that was the twist. He was making work for himself. But what's noticeable is that the pace, if I'm going to show it to my 3-year-old before he goes to bed, it's so much more relaxed and calm than most of the stuff that's being made now, which is like a massive theme park ride.
Oh, you need to watch Moon and Me. Have you seen Moon and Me? If you want slow-paced television, that's slow TV for this generation. It's incredible. And my little daughter's obsessed with it. That's her before-bedtime TV. It's as slow as you can get.
Good tip. Right, magazine publishing now, where The Face has relaunched, well, as a website, but from September as a quarterly print publication. It was an eclectic mix of politics and pop culture in the 1980s, of course. Legendary covers with Kate Moss, Grace Jones, The Stone Roses. Jane, were you surprised to see that The Face is being restarted, not just as a brand, because we knew that the brand had been bought, but eventually as a print title? They are going to have a print version of The Face again.
Well, I am actually delighted, and I'm going to go out and get a print copy of it. I'm not interested. I will not look at it online. I'm afraid that means nothing to me. I want to own it. I want to look at it. I want to feel it. I want to cherish it, because have a very special relationship with The Face. I mean, by the way, I should point out that I'm probably the least likely reader of The Face when I started buying it as an exceptionally nerdy and unfashionable teenager. The Face meant an extraordinary amount to me.
Why?
I think because it represented possibility and a life away from the, obviously what I chose to see as the desperate tedium of my suburban existence.
So subcultures, basically.
Yeah, well, I wasn't daring enough to do or be any of those things I read about or saw in The Face, but I loved being able to get a window on that world. And I should also say that apart from, obviously, births of children and that kind of thing, standing in Smith's in Southport and seeing a copy of The Face and finding out that they'd printed my letter will be one of the best moments of my life.
I mean, it's nice to hear that kind of excitement, isn't it, Faraz? Because for me, it was something that sort of vaguely aroused me in the 90s and then I forgot about.
How can you say that?
I sort of wonder now whether... Actually, if I was excited about it, like Jane is, that's maybe not good news for a publication that's all about fashion and targeting younger people.
Yeah, for me, I would rather it didn't come back because of, for exactly the reasons that Jane said, that I think that it was an artifact of the time, and there's a danger that you bring these things back and suddenly you dilute how impactful they were. This is a really crowded market now, and there are a lot of magazines that didn't exist back when The Face was a big deal. That, you know, there's Wonderland, there's Hunger magazine, you know, and these big, thick, quarterly publications that are 75% fashion advertising, and, you know, a couple of articles here and there, and it's all about the front cover because that's what you put on your coffee table and that's what it's there for. You know, it has a bit of value, and the first edition I'm sure will do very well because it's Welcome Back to The Face. It'll be interesting to know if it's still around a year later.
But actually, if they've got the advertisers on board, that's sort of all that matters, isn't it? If the big fashion houses are excited.
Yeah, in fact, I bought a bunch of magazines for some research that I was doing around video games recently, and there were hardly any adverts in it whatsoever. And all of these magazines that existed beforehand were much thicker, but now they seem to be struggling to get advertisers. And, you know, they were £6-7 for a copy of a magazine, which is a lot of money for a monthly publication. And so in the fashion world, There does seem to be, you know, still a market to get advertising, but it is very crowded now. You know, Days and Confuses out there. Like I said, Hunger's out there. Wonderland is out there. There's a lot of these things. There's a lot of choice, and there's a lot of choice for advertisers as well.
But do they have that mix of kind of reportage and fashion? Because The Face, the edition that my letter was in, was the one with Terry Hall on the
cover.
What
was your letter about? I'm sorry. I should have asked the obvious question.
Yeah, well, obviously I'm going to go back to it. I just have in my subtle radio linking kind of way. It was some kind of feeble three-sentence thing about REO Speedwagon being shit and aren't the English better than Americans, basically. And I didn't use my name. I used some pseudonym. It was pathetic. But I was 17, and this was a very big moment for me. But what was interesting about that that particular edition was that it was mixing a report from Bob Marley's funeral. And then there was fashion, and on the cover art, it was Terry Hall from The Specials was on the cover. I remember this because I did look last night, and it brought it all back to me. I may have.
Just the one issue, or you've got a collection?
No. So do those, I'm not even answering that. Do those other magazines have all that stuff?
Well, there is a lot of space for it. There's certainly a lot of space for it online. And I think that there are smaller, inverted commas, magazines, like Galdo magazine and, you know, Burnt Roti, which looks at South Asian representation, that are much more highly focused on a particular demographic. And they've done, as brands, become very successful. My feeling is that the business plan around this isn't actually the magazine. The business plan around it is to create a brand that you can then sell T-shirts around, that you can then hopefully get a Netflix show of, like, you know, Netflix and The Face Presents, whatever that reportage piece is, which is interesting. You know, BuzzFeed have had mixed success with that sort of thing. Vox Media have had mixed success with that sort of thing. But I think that there is a valuable brand that exists there, but it doesn't. I'll be interested to see if it really connects with the same under 25 demographic that the original Face did, because I don't think they even know what it is or that it exists. Mm. And beyond that, you know, Nowness have existed online for a while. They do really well. You know, I'm doing some teaching, and whenever I speak to students, they're talking about Nowness. It's nice that. Galdem, and then not really understanding what The Face is. It feels like an old piece of nostalgia, which I think it should stay as.
Galdem, I really am interested in that. We've had a number of contributors on Woman's Hour on Radio 4 who've written articles and other stuff, done other stuff for Galdem, and they are always really interesting contributors. You know, they do get some good stuff. And it's stuff that, I must be honest, that programmes, like mainstream programmes like ours, would have struggled to get those voices, actually.
And I suppose the advantage of The Face as a brand, even if you've never heard of it, if you're 25 or whatever, is that the values that it stands for are quite zeitgeisty still, aren't they? Kind of sexually androgynous and a lot of DIY fashion and, I mean, basically the kind of thing you see all over Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that it has a very powerful brand for people that remember the magazine back when it was being published. It's been on hiatus for, what, 15 years or something like that, which is a whole generational shift. And if they want to kind of attract that audience back to them again, I think they're going to struggle. If they want to attract the nostalgia audience, people that listened, that read it 15 years ago, then they may have a limited amount of success there.
Well, but Jane's already in the queue.
Yeah, so I'm there.
there's plenty others, I'm sure. Let's talk about streaming now. You mentioned Netflix. They have impressed investors this week by increasing their subscriber numbers by 9.6 million in the last 3 months, despite mounting competition from Disney and Apple, as we've talked about on this show a lot. Do you think, Jane, Netflix's strategy will continue to work in the face of that competition?
It's a mystery, isn't it, Netflix? I mean, everyone's got it. And I, because I knew I was coming here, I looked. I haven't actually watched anything on Netflix for as long as I can remember. So I looked at what was on offer for me this morning. And apart from the Beyoncé documentary, which I think I will watch, but I'm talking about me personally. There was nothing that grabbed me. But then I don't have a lot more time in my life for more binge watching.
Where do you do your binge watching?
I don't really binge watch very much, and I don't have a lot of time to watch telly, and it would never be my priority. So I do watch stuff, but I often watch linear television, watch one episode, forget to watch any more. So shows like Victim and The Widow, I think I saw the first episode of The Victim, never watched anymore.
It was the guy you thought it was going to be, by the way.
Was it him, by the way? It was
him. I'm not going to say.
It was him, wasn't it? Okay.
There's still people catching up.
And then The Crown comes out in the autumn, Christmas time. I probably will watch that.
The point is, though, that's a success.
What was the question?
Well, it's a success for Netflix.
They're getting my money.
Exactly. I was asking whether their business model is successful, and you're essentially saying yes, because you keep renewing it and occasionally watch it.
Yeah, you've got me there.
I mean, for us, they're spending a lot on original content, aren't they? $12 billion last year. Can that continue?
Well, and my understanding is that the reason that the subscriber numbers have increased is because they've been making progress in countries that didn't have Netflix before. So it's true to say that they've hit saturation points in the UK and the US. I'm sure there's still a little bit of room for growth, but generally, if you want Netflix, you're going to have had it by now. But when it comes to places like this, there's an interesting thing about launching in India, and that's a kind of growth area for a lot of these streamers, whether it's Spotify or it's Netflix. And there's a whole different tactic about, you know, a mobile-first strategy and making things for smaller screens and making things that are available across 3G and 4G networks that they've always been the first at, and that's really, really compelling. And I've forgotten what your question was. Loads of money on content.
I've only asked one question to both of you. Is their business strategy successful?
But there's still a lot of mystery surrounding how many viewers they've got, isn't there?
Well, less so now. So they started to release figures certain shows. And have also said they've cancelled certain shows because they're not getting enough figures.
Okay.
So there is movement there. There's rumours that they're trialling a top 10 feature of the top 10 most watched shows on Netflix to kind of promote in that space. But my favourite game is still looking at other people's Netflix. It's a little bit like when you used to go in people's houses and look at their CD collection. If you log into people's Netflix, it's a different, completely different set of shows from what you get based on their viewing habits. And I always think that that's really compelling. My mum and dad's Netflix suggested program is very, very different to mine, and that's always a lot of fun because
my grandma
watches
a lot of Mexican soap operas, which I didn't even know you could get on Netflix.
Wow.
There's so much stuff that you don't know because it's not targeted at you, and it's, you know, and they are very good at kind of making sure that that programmatic advertising.
Except Jane says they're not. So maybe you haven't been using it enough for it to learn.
I clearly haven't been using it enough, honestly. And I've got Amazon Prime as well. So actually, they have got me absolutely hung out to dry over a barrel, and they've got my money. So they can do what the hell they like with it. And they are doing, clearly, making loads of content for other people to consume.
You were one of the people that came on this show regularly for us and sort of teased ahead to the launch of Apple and Disney entering the streaming service world. as something that could be a game changer. And I haven't had you on the show since we know what they're doing. Now we know what they're doing. It's not that exciting, is it?
Been taken around the back by Disney and Apple and be gagged and told to shut up. No, that's not what's happened at all. So two things. I think that the strategy that both Disney and Apple have, no one really knows what the strategy is for Apple is. I've got some thoughts about it, but certainly for Disney, it feels fairly obvious. If you've got children, you are going to subscribe to Disney Plus. It doesn't matter if you've got Netflix or you've got Amazon already. It looks like an incredible service, and I think that they're doing an incredible job.
Which is purely because of that back catalogue.
Yeah, I mean, it's every Disney movie ever released, which it's important.
And they've taken them off other platforms.
They've taken them off other platforms. And also, they've also unlocked them. So they had this thing called a Disney Vault where you could never buy all of the Disney DVDs at the same time because they created built-in scarcity, which was part of the whole original DVD and VHS strategy that Disney had. That's gone. If you want to watch every Disney movie, you can now do that. If you want to watch every Marvel movie, you can now do that. They own, you know, Star Wars. They've got content coming out with the world's biggest franchises. And they are, you know, going to be able to connect with all of those audiences. And alongside that, they've obviously done this massive deal with Sky as well. And, you know, Nat Geo is going to be on that platform. And they're going to be doing this stuff with Hulu.
It's, okay,
you know,
okay. So excited about that. Fine.
Great.
But Apple isn't very exciting, so is it?
Apple, no. I think,
underwhelmed.
So, I think that Apple's strategy is still unclear, purposely unclear. And I think lots of people are speculating. If you want my 2p or
yes,
2 cents, whatever, or 79p, whatever you want to look at it, I think that what Apple's strategy is you need, and particularly in the UK, it's worth looking at what ITV and Channel 4 are doing. So ITV and Channel 4 are both launching subscription arms to their on-demand players. BritBox is obviously coming, which is a subscription service as well. And what it seems to be happening is that Apple are going to be launching all of these programs to move people into their TV app and therefore allow you to subscribe to all four and ITV, and it becomes effectively a shopfront. So I think that the strategy isn't the same as Netflix or even indeed the same as Disney's. I think what Apple's strategy seems to be is come and open our TV app, which exists on all the devices that you have, including Samsung TVs and LG TVs. You will see Jennifer Aniston and Steven Spielberg and all of these great things, which will draw you into that app. And then when you come to make a decision about whether or not you want to subscribe to BritBox or Hulu or even maybe Disney Plus, you will do that via the Apple TV app, and then they will get a 30% cut of that subscription, which is what their very, very, very successful App Store model has been. And I think that that's where we're going to see their strategy move towards. So I think you need to look at Apple TV as more as a distribution and shopfront strategy.
So they'll be the internet strategy for online telly, basically.
Exactly.
They'll be Chrome,
exactly,
but for TV.
But they don't have Netflix, which is number one. And Netflix have pushed back very hard on subscribing to Netflix via the App Store. You cannot do that via the iPhone app or the iPad app. They've made it very difficult to do that because they don't want to share the revenue with there. Spotify have done the same thing. But if Apple can entice partners like Disney and like Channel 4 and ITV and BritBox and all of those guys, you know, that's a very lucrative amount of money that they will be able to turn over month by month. And it's a very different strategy to what Netflix is doing.
But if they don't have Fireman Sam, Jane...
Well, are they going to do their own original content?
They are doing their own original content. Okay. But I think the way to look at it is that when you buy your phone from Apple, there are original apps on your phone, which are free.
I should say, for the benefit of the listener, Faraz literally held up his phone then.
Here it is.
Like he's doing a demo in the Apple store.
Is this microphone not a camera? Yeah. There are
this Jane is a phone.
But when you buy your Apple product, there are Apple apps on that product, which are regarded as the best for those utilities, but they then push you towards purchasing other apps via their App Store. And I think a similar strategy will probably be followed, but they need to make sure that they have the best possible content so that you do press that Apple TV button and get into that universe.
Okay, we'll be back with more media news after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, Media Podders, you may have noticed we are putting out a few more episodes this year, and that is all thanks to you and your very generous donations to this show. Every time you pledge a piece of money to this show, we plough it back into the podcast, whether that's recording bonus episodes or finding new guests. So help us make great new episodes all year round by taking out a voluntary subscription. If you would be so kind, just head to themediapodcast.com/donate. Time for some media news in brief now. Jane and Faraz are still with me, and let's talk pay gap. Glad you're here, Jane. Yeah, of all the guests, analysis by the Press Gazette has found that nearly a third of UK media firms have seen their gender pay gap actually increase over the last 12 months, and sadly, needless to say, not in favour of the ladies. Jane, what's going on here?
Well, we know what's going on. It's been going on since time itself began. Actually, I could wang on and bore on about this for ages, and I don't want to do that, but I think it's worth repeating a few sort of obvious core facts. The gender pay gap isn't the same as equal pay, for a start. Women's lives and men's lives are not quite the same.
So there are companies that have apparently very bad gender pay gap that might be paying men and women the same.
Well, they've got to pay men and women the same for doing the same work.
Because but they'll if have they more senior men.
That is actually illegal, of course. But this is, of course, where we get into very complicated territory and people lose their minds trying to work all this out. So why are there more men in senior roles getting more money? That's because women's lives and men's lives, working lives, tend to differ slightly when it gets to the stage of families starting to have kids, couples starting to have kids. We know that. What do we do to change the mindset that it's usually the woman who spends the time at home? And I also, you've got to bear in mind, some women want to be at home. I actually was at home myself and I worked part-time so that I could do bits of that and bits of what I wanted to do in the workplace. So women make these decisions and sometimes they make them for very, very good reasons and I would absolutely back them up. What we need to do, obviously, is change the working culture and make it easier for men to feel free to make the same decisions. Some men won't want to make those decisions at all, of course. But there will be some who are actually really desperate to be at home for longer, to be around more for their kids when they are young.
And also easier, I presume, to allow those women who have taken the time whilst their children are growing up out of work to come back at an equivalent or more senior level.
It would be, the women I know, because I'm actually doing something at an event for women returners in a couple of weeks. This is the idea of returnships, getting women back into senior managerial roles after they've been at home for a couple of years. And some of those women they've got MBAs, but they've been at home for a couple of years and they lose confidence in their own ability. They feel they've fallen behind. They won't be taken seriously. And too often the emphasis in those situations is not on what a woman can offer, but she's thinking, what is it I won't be able to do? What is it I won't be able to understand? And women are very reluctant to embrace what they have achieved in that time at home, which is not a walk in the park, although you will spend quite a bit of time in parks based on my own experience. And the other thing I think is really important, there are lots of things that are important here, I've always been told, well, women don't ask for a pay rise. But that's utter rubbish. Women do ask for a pay rise, and all too often they don't get one. There's also the fact that women are not innocent here. So there have been some very senior women at the BBC throughout my time there. And it's all part of, it's in our psyche, women as well as men, to be more likely to rate men than women. So it isn't just men who rate men, women rate men as well.
Is there a complication as well in media terms that a lot of the story's been focused on air talent?
I'm really glad you mentioned that.
It's actually about behind the scenes, really.
It's complete. I mean, the presenter thing, we used it at BBC and with BBC Women. We used the presenters as a way of getting attention.
Yeah.
But we're a tiny, we're not even a pinprick when it comes to actual representation at the BBC. And the ongoing problems we have, situation we have at the BBC, is, as you rightly say, is with producers across the entire organisation who are, have found that they are mysteriously paid unglamorous sums, like $2,000 or $3,000 a year, less than the bloke sitting diagonally opposite them doing the same job. And you think, well, what does that matter? Well, over the course of a career, pensions, everything else, it really does matter.
OK, so, I mean, you've been very vocal about the BBC, obviously, but what about this list now?
No, it's terrible. The BBC, of course, is one of the least worst.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've always known that.
So we have this. So The Economist has the highest pay gap.
So, yeah.
Although their chief exec, Chris Stibbs, says there is, quote, a healthy gender balance in recruitment and career progression.
Let's hope so.
What does success look like? Like, if you're looking at that list of media companies, is it about, because you mentioned all the different factors involved.
Yeah.
Is it about just narrowing the gap more, or is it looking for parity? Is parity actually not really achievable?
I mean, it probably isn't really achievable, but certainly not in my lifetime, I wouldn't think. I think it's already, we've had, God knows, a string of uncomfortable conversations at the BBC about this. And I think it's caused a certain amount of embarrassment that the BBC has been made to look quite old-fashioned. I've got two teenage girls. They look at the BBC and they think, what would this organisation offer me? A place where we've had to listen. Our mother has enjoyed her working life, and I have, I should say. But at the same time, she also bangs on about how she's been underpaid. And women of colour at the BBC are still getting a substantially more challenging time, I would say, than their white counterparts. I think there are some issues at the BBC World Service about the way female producers have been treated. And it's an endless, ongoing string of issues and conversations that we are at least now acknowledging. And we've also formed I don't think it's any secret that we've formed a group who are continuing to talk to each other, to cooperate, to share stories and experiences. And I think possibly people thought we might go away. Well, it's never gone away. That group is getting bigger, and more women are joining and getting involved. So
nicely deflected back to the BBC. Looking at that list of commercial companies, are any of them worthy of mention? Yes, they've done a good job.
Well, I mean,
Dennis Publishing has women paid more than men.
Yeah, well, good, but how? That's great.
NewsQuest as well.
Yeah, okay, that's also brilliant. Obviously, it's very unfortunate.
It's a bit
for
harsh
the men.
On the men. Yeah.
No, but I've just acknowledged that. I've just acknowledged their suffering. These things are obviously not going to be sorted out overnight, except to say that I do think it's important that across all media, women get the same chances as their male counterparts. And because we know that men have dominated in senior positions, I don't think there is any doubt at all across all forms of media, certainly not just the BBC, people have appointed in their own image. They have given opportunities to people with whom they might have gone for a drink, played golf with back in the day, chatted to about West Ham. All of these things do matter. I remember when I joined BBC Local Radio, there would be a cluster of male producers and editors who would stand around the cricket, jangling the change in their trouser pockets and talking to me and my female colleagues incomprehensible gibberish about what was going on the screen. And
I would have been completely out of my depth as well.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. But we did feel that we were slightly outside that. And actually, we were right to feel it because we were.
I mean, the problem is, Baraz, even if everyone, which I'm not saying is happening, I'm not saying there isn't a problem, but even if everyone in the industry agreed with everything Jane just said and says, yes, there's a huge problem here and we must work towards it, the solution might mean moving on very successful male bosses to equalise pay. And the problem is, if you're doing a good job, that's its own form of discrimination at this point, isn't it? It's more of a long-term thing than that.
That's not what I heard from what Jane was saying.
Said female bosses were a part of this too. And
yeah,
the only way to address the pay inequality would be to have more female bosses, which means some of those male bosses moving on, doesn't it?
Well, there's a whole bigger issue about how long people stay in the top jobs and you know, how quickly that rotation happens, and is that a good thing or a bad thing for a creative industry? I would argue that, you know, more rotation is a good thing to keep, you know, creative renewal alive. There's also this problem also exists with people of colour. You know, this is, and I think that there's also an issue around there, because I agree with Jane that just had a new child and she doesn't want to work full time, and we're a small company that has very limited funds and we can't afford to have a head of development that works full time. So that's a situation situation that works for both of us. Now, if you were to inspect our company, you could argue that there's a massive gender pay gap because me as a male is working full time, and Jess and Dee, who don't want to work full time, are therefore earning less, and therefore there's a massive disparity there. But we've actually actively hired people that want to be more flexible because they don't want to work full time, and so sometimes these figures can be slightly misleading. But we do need to make sure that we interrogate them properly and make sure there aren't problems. And if these surveys spark conversations, and that's inherently a good thing. But I don't think it's as simple as there is discrimination going on or there's an issue going on. I think that there are lots of reasons and causes about why we have these imbalances, and we need to kind of interrogate all of them and find out if there are some advantages along the way.
It will be interesting when the BBC puts out its figures again in the summer. I think there'll be more women, because actually the problem looking at that league table last summer, it was actually worse last year than it had been the year before when everything kicked off. Surely this summer is going to show a few more high-earning women on that list. But also, there are some subtler points about this. The highest-earning woman, who was Claudia Winkleman, what is interesting is that she has a degree from Cambridge. She is a highly intelligent woman, but that isn't the reason she's paid such an enormous sum of money by the BBC. So she isn't Andrew Marr or a big-brained man. Although there are plenty of highly intelligent women who work for the BBC, she's doing light entertainment brilliantly. But the blokes who are earning loads of money tend to be valued for their mega brains. And I think that's another thing that is probably going to have to change.
Well, the good news for me at the Media Podcast is the producers here would struggle to find anyone of any gender who'd do this job for my salary. Let's move on to talk about the nominations for the British Podcast Awards, released this week for the third year running. They're actually called the British Podcast Awards, powered by DAX, I've been told by the producer to say.
What's DAX? DAX is?
It's like the Chris Evans Show with Sky. That's just how you say it. The nominations were announced in a live stream by the cast of No Such Thing as a Fish, who admitted they'd been too slow to submit their entry before the deadline, so they weren't nominated. But Jane, you are with Fee Glover, fortunately.
Yeah, oh, so are you.
Congratulations. So am I, yes, for the Modern Man. Very kind of you to mention.
Made a podcast yet. We are making a podcast this year, but we've not made a podcast
I'm sure it'll
yet.
Be nominated next year.
Minimum entry criteria is you must make a podcast. Any highlights from the nominees, apart from what we've already discussed?
Well, obviously, fortunately, yes. Although Fee and I are nominated in a category, I simply have no idea what it means. But we'll happily take Spotlight.
Spotlight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that might mean diverse.
Okay. But it's open to interpretation.
Yeah, I really couldn't find a nomination for them in any other category, so I've shoved them in this one.
This podcast has been recorded one light bulb ahead of you.
Yes. Yeah, I really don't know what it means. Anyway, we're highly delighted.
It's a good, fun event, may I
say. Is it? Well, we're going. Yeah,
and
we're going.
Well, I'm going too, and good. I'm not presenting it this year, so I get to get drunk, so I look forward to seeing you there.
Okay, well, I'll definitely be there. And I do love podcasts. In fact, it's probably because I love podcasts that I don't listen or I don't watch much Netflix. Mm. Or Amazon Prime. And I certainly won't be watching Apple TV or indeed Disney Plus. But I did listen to Dear Joan and Jerrica.
Yes.
And they have rightly been nominated.
This is the Julia Davis thing.
Julia Davis and Vicky Pepperdine. And it's absolute, unadulterated, challenging, quite upsetting filth.
Mm.
Which I liked.
Yeah, it's not your easygoing driving soundtrack, but I suppose that's the point of podcasting, isn't it? Faraz, do you have any highlights?
Looking at the list, the big story seems to be George the Poet. It seems that he's nominated in lots of different categories, and he's most nominated. I'm looking at Matt and Ollie.
He put out very few episodes, actually.
And it's an amazing podcast as well. It's beautifully produced, and I hope that he picks up some gongs as a result. I was quite surprised that Brexit cast is surprisingly absent. I think that Brexit cast is the big breakout podcast of the year.
Did they not enter?
I don't know the answer to that, but it just feels like there's from where I'm standing, that's the thing that everyone's talking about. That's the kind of the porno or the serial of the year. I was kind of expecting to see that being shortlisted in lots of different categories. Maybe they've been too busy trying to figure out what the withdrawal agreement says, or they were hoping they could kick the can down the road when they were making their application. But whatever reason that I haven't seen them on the list. But there's as ever, this award ceremony causes me great anxiety because it shows me that there's lots of stuff that I'm not listening to that's really great and I really don't want to subscribe to because my podcast list is just growing exponentially and I haven't got enough hours in a day.
I liked End of Days as well, the Five Live podcast about Waco, which I thought was brilliantly done. And And what's the other great thing about podcasts is it tells you stories you hadn't heard. And I didn't know about the British victims at Waco. Mm. I just didn't know. Mm. I don't know why I didn't know, but I didn't know. And I found myself completely immersed in that. I thought that was really, really good.
Yeah, and with a level of detail as well, I guess, that you just wouldn't get in a 5-minute news report, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the awards are on the 18th of May. We will bring you news of them when they happen. And Dax, by the way, for us, is an advertising, dynamic advertising insertion type podcasting company.
Isn't it a robot in a sci-fi series?
It is also that. and it's owned by Global, who are the centre of our next story, in fact. Global have been given the go-ahead to take over billboard advertising company Experian Media. That comes hot on the heels of their purchase last year of two other out-of-home advertising firms, PrimeSight and Outdoor Plus. We talked about it on the show like it was a done deal, but it wasn't actually. It is now. And Global are now 35% of the UK outdoor market. Faraz, why do you think Global are so keen on billboards?
They're doing all right, Global, aren't they? They seem to be like spending a lot of money and getting the cash cannon out. It makes sense that they, you know, I think outdoor space is an interesting space. I was reading an article recently about how football advertising can be made dynamic now. So when you see it on a TV program, you can change it depending on what country you're watching that football show on. So the hoardings around it may say one brand in one country and a different brand in a different country. You know, with the advent of more technology, meaning that you can put 15 different adverts on one billboard, it seems like this is becoming a more and more lucrative space. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they do with all of that and if they are now going to be the people that effectively brand a country. But fair play to them. If they want to spend some money in this space, then there's obviously a business for it.
Slightly awkward thing, Jane, is that they own buses, for example, contracts to plaster radio stations across buses, which are much frequented by BBC Sounds, Magic, I've seen ads for at the moment, yeah. Absolute. You know, if you're Bauer or the BBC, does it just stick in the throat that you've got to give a load of money to Global to advertise your own radio station?
It is going to be awkward. You do sometimes wonder when Global are going to stop buying things. I mean, are they going to make a bid for the BBC?
Well, it is probably a fair point. They've run out of radio stations to buy. And
so
they've all been hoovered
now
up,
looking
they?
For more stuff.
More
yeah.
stuff, yeah.
OK. Well, I've got a couple of garden chairs they could have if they're interested. I mean, it is... Does it mean that you'll be driving along the Hogarth, whatever it is, and there'll be a ginormous Nick Ferrari coming at you 24 hours a day?
Mustn't it? Is in the downtime for the billboards?
Presumably they could live stream their shows.
I think
onto
that is
billboards.
When they've already started doing that, so you can actually drive down the M40 and see a big poster of Ian Dale saying this is on right now. And
I suppose the idea is surely there's an internal market for it. I mean, if you know they if BBC Sounds want to give Global a lot of money to advertise on their billboards, they're going to take that money. There is a question about the inventory, the unused inventory, but that's not a good thing for Global. If people aren't buying that ad space and they're having to put their own stuff on it, that suggests that they probably shouldn't have bought that much ad space. So I'm sure that, like, you know, there's a kind of a little bit of a hedge between the two businesses, and we won't necessarily see this being used just because it's not very good use of space, that it's just all going to be used for Ian Dale adverts and Nick Ferrari adverts. So I imagine that this is a different business.
Here is something we don't usually do on the programme. Recommend a book. BBC Newsnight presenter Emily Maitlis is on the press junket trail at the moment talking about Airhead, good title, The Imperfect Art of Making News. It's a sort of autobiography. Have you heard about it, Jane?
Yes, I have. Well, yeah, Emily was a very good guest, unfortunately, the award-nominated podcast.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, and she was very funny, actually, and quite revealing about her regime of hair styling. She has her hair done by a retired Albanian army general who comes round on a motorbike 3 times a week. It's just something I'll never forget about Emily Maitlis.
We all would if we could.
I would like to read the book, actually. I don't think I'd pay for it. It's one of those things I'll wait to grab off the shelf at work, Emily. Or you could just send me a copy at Woman's Hour. It's actually interesting, to go back to the pay thing, Emily was involved in sort of kicking off the whole BBC Women thing when she retweeted a tweet that I'd tweeted. And from then on, I was going to call it a movement, but that sounds a little grand, but that's sort of where...
A chain of events.
But yeah, because she was not especially... her pay was the subject of quite a lot of controversy, and I think that has been changed now. So,
and we're in a different world in terms of her profile, too. I mean, she is now heading up Newsnight.
She is now the chief interrogator, yes, on Newsnight.
And very much valued for her brain. I mean, you said that BBC Women,
yeah,
not necessarily...
She wasn't valued as much as Claudia Winkleman was valued for pretending she didn't have a brain, which is effectively what she does when she's on strictly. That's not a criticism of her, it's just an observation.
But there actually are, aren't there, Faraz, it seems to me, especially since Brexit, a sort of tranche of women across current affairs who are being valued in ways perhaps they weren't. I'm thinking of people like Laura Koonsberg and Katja Adler.
I think for the BBC, I think their female journalists at the moment are firing on all cylinders. They're more interesting, they're giving better insight, they tell stories in a better way, and I think that they're the best in the business. I think, as you mentioned, Laura Koonsberg, Kirsty Walk, and Emily Maitis are all doing exceptional work and far out, well, I would argue, if far out, not to pit them against each other, but far outgunning their male counterparts at the moment.
Oh, you can. You can say that.
But it's true. I mean, you will want to... And I think it's not just in the UK. I think what Maggie Haberman is doing with the New York Times in the US, you know, she is now pretty much the face of the New York Times right now. And it really demonstrates that the art of storytelling through journalism is, at the moment, feels like it's being absolutely nailed by that side of the gender balance.
You're right. I mean, Laura and Katja Adler are both incredibly fluent, articulate speakers who can make really dense, complicated issues seem relevant to people like me who do have an interest, but I'm by no means an expert. And they both really come to life on Brexitcast as well, which is the format that allows them to be human and funny. And it's a generalisation, but I wonder sometimes whether the great BBC male political editors were... I'm glad they're not in charge at the moment, because I'm not sure they'd have been quite so light on their feet in terms of the verbal dexterity required at the moment. And also...
I do enjoy the odd cheeky question from Pinar, let's be fair.
Oh, no, Big John. I mean, no one argues with him, and certainly not me. No, you're right. I mean, he's a legend, John. Where he was the big politics guy at Five Live for a long time. So, I do hugely admire them. And Emily's book, I will read it. I'm sure it is going to be interesting. Also, I read a review, the one you sent me, that suggested...
It was in The Guardian, yes, if you're interested in checking it.
That there wasn't quite enough about her personal... they wanted. And actually, I would say she's... Because various things that have happened, I defend her, right? Why should she bring us her personal story? We don't demand that stuff from men, usually. Or not if men in a similar high role, high profile, intelligent, intellectual role. They're not usually required to
I think I disagree with you. Nick Robinson wrote about his cancer, didn't he? And I would have been weird if he hadn't in his book.
Okay, well, maybe... Well, we're not going to argue, are we? Because I'm simply never wrong.
I just think
that's
the most
wrong.
Obvious comparison.
No, I just think sometimes... and she'd had an issue with the stalker, and I understand she does write about the stalker in her book. But I think sometimes women are... You're meant to give more of your personal stuff. And sometimes you think, well, why the hell should I? And so I quite admire her for not going there, actually.
Well, so we're nearly done, but you'll be pleased to know, Jane, we want a little bit more from you, because there is just time for our media quiz. This week, it's entitled The Things Spokespeople Say. I have three quotes from the past 7 days of media news. You just buzz in with your name when you know who said it and if what they said bears any relation to reality. Best of three. I know, Jane, you're new to this, so you buzz in with your name when you know the answer. So, Jane, you will say...
Jane.
And Faraz, you will say...
Faraz.
Okay, here's quote number one. We regularly review what is on offer. We offer a wide range of titles to give our customers plenty of digital and print options for news, business and leisure reading material.
Oh, Faraz, is this the world's favourite airline?
It is, yes. A spokesperson for BA. Do you remember the story?
It's the FT being pulled from... I say being pulled, but no longer being offered to customers as they enter their plane cabin.
It was quite a fun spat to follow, wasn't it? The FT published a full page. Well, the FT published a full page saying that the reason was because they'd written unflattering things about British Airways, and BA say, no, we just review our media content periodically, and for some reason, the Financial Times is no longer suitable material. I'm sort of with the FT on it, but yeah.
What do you reckon? Do you reckon they pulled it because of the stories they were writing?
I think so, Faraz, yes.
I think you might be right.
Here is press spokesperson number two, buzzing with your name when you know the answer. These panels are triggered algorithmically, and our system sometimes make the wrong call.
Faraz, is this YouTube?
It is YouTube. Were you close, Jane? You were pipped there.
Oh, I'm going to say I was close. Yeah. Not really close indeed, yeah.
Do you remember the story?
Well, this is about them like saying that when you search for something that you get given fact-checking information.
Specifically?
It was going to be from Wikipedia, but it's now from... It's like I imagine it's like...
Come on, What caught fire this week?
Oh, Notre Dame.
Yeah,
for a bonus
that.
Point.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Were they blaming it on Muslims? That's probably what they were doing.
Essentially.
Right,
so
brilliant.
What
okay,
happened
great.
Is there are conspiracy theories online, and YouTube have automated procedures to take that stuff down, fake news, so that if you're Googling it, it automatically directs you to a page which basically says, take your medicine, have a look at this, and think about it before you watch it. But they accidentally recommended 9/11 conspiracy theories because...
Is that true?
Yes, because their algorithm identified a plume of smoke and thought it was 9/11.
God.
Here's spokesperson number 3, buzzing with your name when you know the answer. I'm sure many of us will have made a mistake at work. Unfortunately for me... Oh, Jane?
Jane.
Yes, it is.
Jane
who?
Secker.
Yes. Sky News presenter Jane Secker. Do you remember the context?
It was about renting.
Yes.
And I can see both sides here.
Go on.
Well, partly it struck me as I often find myself in similar role to Jane Secker, interviewing somebody who could be my child, and they just end up... They sort of grind you down. There's something about it that makes you think, it's a generational irritation.
So the situation was Jane Secker, it turns out, is a landlord.
Yes.
And she was interviewing a young lady,
a young woman,
who's a
yeah,
renter
yeah,
and
yeah.
a protester against dodgy landlords.
Yeah. And she was, the young woman who was a protester had every right to have her say.
And was it right to apologise?
It probably was right in this instance. I've done it myself. I've just taken the wrong tack, used the wrong tone. I feel for, like I say, I genuinely do have sympathy with both sides here. Sometimes when you're live interviewing somebody, you get it wrong.
Very good work. For us, though, you are the winner.
Hooray!
Today's edition.
They should let
me
women because I'm a girl. It's not fair. This is always what happens.
That is it for our show for today. My thanks to Jane and to Faraz. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, but next week on this feed will be another edition of the Media Business Podcast, in which the team will be talking sales, so stay subscribed for that. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.